Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. These are normal and obvious causes of the invisibility of the poor. They operated a generation ago. They will be functioning a generation hence. It's more important to understand that the very development society is creating is a kind of blindness about poverty. It is increasingly slipping out of the very experience and consciousness of the nation. The real explanation of why the poor are where they are is that they made the mistake of being born to the wrong parents, in the wrong section of the country, in the wrong industry, or in the wrong racial or ethnic group. Once that mistake has been made, they could have been paragons of will and morality, but most of them would never even have had a chance to get out of the other America. Michael Harrington wrote that 49 years ago in a book that some have said was the impetus for the war on poverty started by President Lyndon Baines Johnson. The book was The Other America, and it is chilling to read it now and realize that the same exists 49 years later. We were extremely alarmed when we read the Census Bureau numbers showing the number of people, children particularly, who are living in poverty. The number of children in Milwaukee who are living in poverty or near poverty is astronomically high. And we thought that this deserved more than one show, certainly, but it's also remarkable that so little has been discussed. We hear about the middle class all the time. What about the poor among us? So we will pay attention to that issue this hour of the program. We will have two guests with us. Dr. Curtis Skinner is here, and he works for the National Center for Children in Poverty. They have done really valuable research on breaking down exactly who is poor. They look at year by year the number of people who are poor, the number of children poor. And instead of just looking at the poverty level, they look at what it takes in order to be able to feed and clothe a family of four. He is a labor economist and joined the National Center for Children in Poverty in 2010 to direct the Family Economic Security Team. He brings expertise in the implications of the changing U.S. occupational structure for adults with limited education. He's a practicing economist and has conducted research and policy analysis in the fields of workforce development, labor demand, immigration, and housing for nonprofit organizations. Professor Curtis Skinner, we thank you very, very much for being with us.
Oh, it's great to be here. Yeah. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. Also joining us is Octavia Brown. She's here for the beginning of the show. She is a Head Start parent and a member of the Parents Council's Executive Committee. She lives in Milwaukee and is employed full-time and can tell us about poverty. Thank you very much, Octavia, for joining us.
No problem. How are you?
I'm okay. How are you?
I'm good, thank you.
Good, good. Thanks so much for being with us. Let us start, Professor Skinner, with you. You know, I must say that I was absolutely astounded to read about the number of people, children, who are living in low-income families in this country. When you break it down by racial group, it's just unbelievable. It's way over half.
Yes, it's a very large number indeed. It's quite shocking. These are people up to 200% of the poverty line. And it's a large, large number indeed. It's about 104 million people and about 40% of children.
40% of children. And when you look at African-American families or Hispanic families, the number is much larger.
The number is much larger, yes. That's true with poverty and with low income. It's not evenly distributed across groups. A number of groups bear a much greater poverty burden.
Tell me what the difference is between poverty and low income.
Well, poverty is measured according to a standard by the federal government, which sets a threshold in dollar terms, which is adjusted by the size of the family, and it's updated just for the rate of inflation for every year. It's a very basic, almost a primitive standard. It's based on what it costs to buy a basic needs meal budget. And then that's multiplied by three. And it's kind of a very antiquated methodology because it goes back to the 1950s and 1960s when, in fact, Food expenses are about one-third of a typical family's household expenses. Well, that's dropped down to about 15%. And other necessities have become much more a bigger part of the family budget, things like housing and medical care.
Mm-hmm.
So there's moves afoot to try to improve the poverty measurement here, but we're still using to measure the poverty rate this official standard. So that sets these different thresholds of different families. So a family of four with two parents and two children, the threshold is about $22,100 per year in terms of income. So if you're below that threshold, you're poor.
Mm-hmm.
If you're above it, you're not poor.
Mm-hmm. Octavia, let's talk to you for a moment. Do you consider yourself a struggling mom, or are things economically okay for you?
They were economically okay. You know, once your company downsizes and you're out of a job, there's really not much to turn. So, I mean, you really have to take the initiative to get out here and seek public assistance. Right now, I do work a part-time job, and I do go to school full-time. So even with the assistance, it's still a daily struggle to provide for your children and to make a better life for them. So I guess it just depends on your position in life, whether you're really, really hardworking or whether you just kind of, you know, take the back seat and say, okay, I'm not going to do anything at all. I think that that is what will measure you, whether or not you're in poverty or whether or not you're poor. So
mm-hmm.
I think if you just constantly push and make a better person out of yourself and get out of that threshold, you'll definitely be successful.
That's a difficult task, though, to have a part-time job and to go to school full-time and to raise children, which is more than a full-time job.
Definitely.
You were downsized. Were you with a company and you had a pretty good paycheck and then the company downsized and you lost a job?
Yes, I was working full-time as a help desk advisor with HP, and it was actually a contract job. So after about a year, I did lose my position, and I went from making about $35,000 on salary to, you know, really under poverty level, and it's a big adjustment financially, especially when you don't really have the expertise that other people have to just go and apply for a job and get it right away. You just have to, you know, like I said, just keep pushing forward, and that's what I'm doing right now. Know, going to school full time and trying to make a difference for not only myself but my children and the people I network with at the school at SDC, and just, you know, make a realization that this is not the end of the line, but, you know, you just got to keep pushing for it.
Yeah. Are you retraining? Did you go back to school to take up another field?
Actually, I got the job because of my schooling. I go to school right now for my bachelor's in technical management, and I will be done with that in June, so I'm very proud of that. So I did get the job based on my education. They saw that I was going to school, and they really took pride in that, and they just kind of wanted to give me an opportunity to work in the field and get some hands-on experience. But I just haven't had the opportunity to go back into the field, you know, especially with the jobs out here. They want you to have so much expertise, so much education, so much experience, and it's definitely hard to get back to where I was.
Mm-hmm. Professor Skinner, from your statistics, the analysis you've done, it really appears to me that you have a much better chance if you were doing as Octavia is doing, and that's getting at least a college degree here. The amount of money that you will make if you can find a job is just much, much larger than having a high school degree or not even a high school degree.
That's right. It is indeed. We're seeing this phenomenon in the labor market that increasingly to get, you know, to make a living wage, you need a four-year college education or more. And that has a structural change in the economy. It's made it much more difficult to get a middle income living wage sort of job if you're a high school graduate, and certainly if you're less than a high school graduate, it's extremely difficult.
Mm-hmm.
So definitely, Ms. Brown is absolutely, that's the way to go to try to improve that, get that degree,
mm-hmm.
And also have that job experience. But even that, you know, it's been tough. It's been a tough recession and a post-recession. We're supposedly over it, but we still got this, you know, a lot of big problems on the job market, and it's been worse for less educated people, that's for sure, but it's been bad pretty much across the board.
How many children do you have, Octavia?
I have two children. I have a 6-year-old son and a 3-year-old daughter.
What do you do about childcare, which can be extremely expensive?
Childcare was another big adjustment. I was used to paying for it out of my pocket. I was paying like $175 a week for childcare. and right now I do receive childcare through the government. So they do give me a set amount of hours per week where you have to give them proof of employment, what your wages, what your hours are. So they kind of base it off of that. And even with that, it helps, but, you know, you have some daycares out here that close at 6 p.m., and, you know, you have some jobs out here where you work well past 6 p.m., so it's kind of a win-lose situation, if you will.
And then all it takes to throw everything off is to have your child get sick.
Yeah, definitely, yes.
Yeah. What about the kinds of programs that are available, or are there a lack of them, Professor Skinner, to help people like Octavia move ahead in the world? I mean, childcare can be a real difficult thing. Are we supporting people in this regard?
It's, you know, part of welfare reform back in the mid-90s under President Clinton was to make sure, you know, they began to make these requirements to limit the amount of lifetime period that you could receive temporary assistance to needy families, and also encourage people to get in the labor market and to get jobs. And as part of that, there was a promise to make sure to give people the supports they need, especially single mothers, to allow them to work. And in terms of giving them help for childcare subsidies, and also help for transportation. So we do have this childcare subsidy program. It's partly funded by the federal government and partly funded by the states. The problem is it tends to be quite inadequate, and increasingly you're lucky to get it because a number of states are cutting back on the program, and only some studies have shown that only about 15% of families that are eligible to get public child care subsidies are getting them. Mm-hmm. That's a very small amount, and the research has shown that it's really key to getting single mothers in particular, to getting them into jobs, to allowing them to keep their jobs and raise their income and rise up the career ladder, having effective child support, child subsidies is key to that.
Yeah.
So it's a source of concern in this period of real financial crises for the states and cutbacks. We're very concerned that the child care subsidies not be put on the block.
Right. And Octavia, I know you've got a busy day here. We'll let you go in a moment, but I'm wondering about your Head Start. Head Start was a product of that Other America attention that I talked about 49 years ago in this country. Tell me how your children are benefiting from Head Start, and from your knowledge of the program, has it expanded? Are there more opportunities for low-income and poor children to get involved in Head Start?
I think so. I've put both my children in Head Start, and they really, it gives them an opportunity to kind of break away from daycare and get into a structured classroom setting, and to give them that upper hand so when they do start kindergarten or first grade that they're already, you know, functioning the way they're supposed to. So you have trained staff, you have people who help you, they give you resources. And it's not just a head start for the child, it's a head start for the parent too, because you just have such an awesome support system, I think. When I went in, I didn't know anything about being a part of the executive committee or, you know, being a parent who is concerned and shifting how Head Start prepares our children for the future. And now that I'm a part of that network, it's definitely it's definitely outstanding to know that there's a support system to help us single parents and help the children take a step forward and to make better people of ourselves. And I think if more parents got involved and if more parents were knowledgeable about what Head Start could provide, not only for the child but for the families, it would make such a bigger difference. You know, everybody has busy lives and everybody, you know, is running around trying to get things together. But if you only take a day out the week or a day out the month and just sit down with other parents and just kind of brainstorm to see how you can better things for everybody else, I think it'll push us forward a little more. And that's kind of across the board. That's for any racial group, any, you know, financial situation, any educational background, anybody. You know, anybody can just sit down and volunteer for a day and just get some insight as to how we can make this program better. And I honestly think that Head Start is definitely the way to go, you know, when you're trying to put yourself out there and get a better understanding of how things work. It's a great place to start.
Yeah. Thank you, Octavia, for joining us. All the best to you in all that you're doing.
Definitely. Thank you for the opportunity. I wish, I want to just all the listeners out there, I just want you guys to know that we are out here making a difference. And I stand very proud to be a representative of SDC and Head Start today. So I do thank you for your time and encouragement.
Yeah, thank you, Octavia Brown. Professor Skinner, am I wrong in thinking that the whole Head Start program and the remnants of the war on poverty, perhaps there aren't very many of them, but Head Start is one of them, and a valuable one, is it?
Yes, it is. It really is. Head Start has been shown to really help kids with both their cognitive development, small children, and also their socialization skills in a school setting. There have been many studies done of the Head Start program. And in general, I think it's just a terrific program. And unfortunately, it's only funded, again, it's a limited pot of money for Head Start, which is federally funded, and it's only about an estimated 50%, about half of children eligible for Head Start actually get into the program. So that's again, a source of concern. It'd be great to be able to have to expand this program, because increasingly there's a body of knowledge done by very reputable researchers. One is James Heckman, who's a Nobel Prize winner at the University of Chicago, and no liberal, actually. But he's done quite a bit of work on investing in early children, investing in their cognitive skills and developing their ability to work in school settings. There's a famous program called the Perry Preschool Program that he and others have tracked children who were enrolled in this program that gave them a lot of support, low-income children in poverty in the Chicago area when they were very young. And then track them into adulthood, because the program has been around for quite a while. And you see these big, big gains all the way through adulthood in terms of educational attainment, in terms of earnings. A lot is given back to society, of course, because, you know, society garners greater tax payments and these become more productive workers. And so it seems clear that it's important to invest in children at an early age. And Head Start is one of those programs.
Let's take at least one phone call, and then we'll continue our conversation. We're looking at poverty in this country, and our guest is Professor Curtis Skinner, director of the Family Economic Security Team at the National Center for Children in Poverty. Victor is our first caller. Hi, Victor.
Good morning. Good morning to your guest. First, I'd like to say, you know, my prayers to Olivia Brown. She's a great testimony on how insurmountable problems, it seems, can be overcome, and she was wonderful. I'd like to point out that there should be a solution to this, and it is prevention. You have to ask yourself and to ask these young men and women who are bringing children into this world, why? Why are you bringing children into the world that they know in their minds, cannot afford to bring up? It is not pointing a finger at them or it's not being judgmental, but there's a fact. Wisconsin and Milwaukee notoriously has a teen pregnancy rate. Regardless if they're black, Asian, Latino, or white, we have to reach out to these young men and women not to bring children to the world they cannot afford. As far as training, I would emphasize more vocational training than four-year college degrees or master's degrees, because it's being neglected. Vocational training, to me, will give a young man or woman a better chance of immediate employment versus a university degree.
Professor Skinner.
I think those are both very important points. To talk about the vocational training first, I think that's absolutely on the money. It's a bit of a source of concern with vocation. I think it's been neglected, and I think this idea that, you know, one size fits all, everybody go and get the four-year degree, is not realistic. I mean, it's just not what some people want to do, and people can certainly contribute and be productive without having a four-year college degree. I guess the point I was making earlier is that you do see that increasingly there's a big difference in earnings between those that got this four-year degree and other members of the labor force. But I think that point's very well taken, and I think in terms of there are certain, always there are going to be certain highly skilled occupations that need folks trained in this work and that don't require a four-year college degree. And a number of high schools or public high school systems are heading more toward this direction. Here in New York, where we are, there's a number of schools that are taking this approach, emphasizing it more than they did before, and really, really combining academic training with the usual stuff you do in high school with a specific focus on how this relates to different occupations, vocations. So I think that's an important point to make. It's a bit of a source of concern that in this recession, you do see, you're seeing in Wisconsin in particular, I'm just looking, going through the unemployment figures, where you are seeing the higher unemployment is in occupations that are more vocational in nature. So things like folks in maintenance and repair and production and transportation, that's where you're seeing the higher unemployment rates.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a balance. I think the point is very well taken.
And what about the teen pregnancy rate? Is it going down around the country?
Well, it has been going down recently. And in fact, I just happened to find some statistics from Wisconsin, produced by there's this wonderful organization. It's called the Kids Count Data Book. It comes out every year, and it's produced by the Annie E. Casey Foundation, and they do these studies for what's happening with children in health and well-being in every state. And I was looking at some of the Wisconsin numbers, and according to them, between 2000 and 2008, Wisconsin showed improvement in child deaths, that is lower deaths, teen births, lower teen births, high school dropout, and percentage of babies born at low birth rate. And I think in the nation, the numbers generally in the last few years of teen births have thankfully gone down because, again, Victor made, I think, a very good point, which is that you know, you do have this high correlation between you know, young single parents and poverty, because it's very difficult to keep afloat when you're very young and you've already got this responsibility for a child.
Thank you, Victor, very much for your call, and we'll take more of them in a moment. We're looking at poverty this hour of the program, and the very large number of children in this country who are living in poverty or low income, and why that is the case and why there hasn't been a whole lot of national attention devoted to this. We'll ask our guest why he thinks that's the case in a moment and take more of your calls. 800-486-8655 is the number. The email is talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We'll return to your phone calls in a moment. Let me ask you, Professor Skinner, maybe you have a different perception, but we follow the news pretty closely here, and it seems to me as though the amount of attention that we have been paying to taxing the middle class and the growth of the middle class and the middle class being the backbone of American society, I can't tell you when I've heard any politician devote any amount of time to the poor among us, and the numbers are increasing, and the problem, it would appear to me, is just as invisible as it was 49 years ago when Harrington wrote The Other America.
I would sadly have to agree with you. I mean, we've been disappointed that even progressive or more progressive political figures, starting with President Obama, don't talk about poverty.
No, nobody does.
Word isn't mentioned. They also don't talk about the working class. So
right.
It's everything is middle class.
Right.
And that's kind of a myth we have in this country and that people like to perpetuate. And I think that you know, everyone's middle class and that, you know, poverty is not a major problem, but it needs to come out into the open. It is an embarrassment. It's an embarrassment for us as a society, but we have to look at those numbers, be embarrassed, and start working on it. And I do think it needs to be made front and center in political and social discourse.
So what's different about now? When you look at that book that came out and the war on poverty and the attention that people like Robert Kennedy paid to the issue of poverty, and we were concerned about it. I was a young person in those days, but I remember reading this guy's book and was just knocked out by it, and remembering Kennedy's trip to Appalachia and all of that. What happened to the issue?
Well, it's a good question. I mean, I think during that period in the 60s and what led up to the great President Johnson's Great Society programs and the war on poverty, we had such a very different political climate back then. We had we had the civil rights movement. We had the anti-Vietnam War movement. We had a lot of folks concerned about entrenched poverty that was clearly growing in major cities in the U.S., and they were the urban riots. There was a lot going on, I think, to kind of force, for better or for worse, to force the issue into the policy agenda back then. And since then, some progress was made, and some progress was made pretty fast. And when you look back at the numbers for child poverty in the late 60s and early 70s when those programs got started, you see the poverty rate for children dropping to, say, 14%. Now it's 22%.
Oh my goodness!
So we have yet to go back to those child poverty rates and adult poverty rates as well, but especially when we're looking at children, we have yet to reach those rates that were attained decades ago in the late 60s and early 70s. And it wasn't just the programs, although the programs certainly helped. To be sure, it was a different economy, and it was an economy that was more inclusive,
yes,
and that had more living wage jobs for people with, you know, without a college degree, without even necessarily a high school degree. And so we do have these structural changes that have happened in the economy that I think are also contributing to more families, working families, still being still falling below the poverty line.
Let's go to Cody in Oshkosh. Hi, Cody.
I just wanted to mention, in defense of the discussion being centered on the middle class or the working class, right at this point, the working class is having a hard time getting out of that and going to middle class as opposed to going back to poverty. I grew up with an educated family. I'm educated myself. I make $11 an hour with a master's degree. So, and my health benefits are going down. We need a strong safety net, but we need a new economic model in this country that's going to work. We're never going to go back to manufacturing the way we did in the 50s and 60s, and we have to start talking about economic models.
Right. Well, it's a very good point, and it's a difficult thing. But I do think that with jobs are something that can be structured in many different ways, occupations. And it seems to me that now what we're seeing is kind of what we call a bifurcated job market, where you see growth among very highly skilled, highly educated folks, skilled in terms of book learning and technical knowledge. So you see growth with people with professional degrees, and then you see growth at the low end with jobs requiring service economy, jobs that require very little skill of any kind, really. And you see this kind of hollowing out in what we call mid-skilled jobs and jobs that paid a living wage. And I think that one thing that can be thought about is structuring incentives to companies to create more of these jobs that use kind of mid-level skills. And it could be a complicated thing to do, but I think it's something that needs to be looked at, because what's happening is not something that necessarily has to happen. It's something that is happening because incentives for businesses are the way they are, and if those incentives can be changed, and if also we can change institutions that can help drive some of those changes, like make it a little easier for unions to organize, I think that's a big part of the picture too. The decline in union representation that was able to support these mid-skilled jobs. If we can make that easier with programs like Card Check and making it easier to organize, I think that'll be some help as well. But it is, to be sure, a complicated problem.
Thank you, Cody. Diane in Milwaukee. Hi, Diane.
Good morning. If you want your child to be receptive to education, You have to have adequate nutrition when the child is in the womb and in his early childhood. If you don't have the nutrition, you're just not going to create a brain that is going to be able to learn. We're cutting WIC. We're making a nation of peons.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely correct. The research is clearly supports that. And it's interesting that during the course of the Great Recession, WIC has grown and quite a bit. People are accessing it more and more, but then now there have been some cuts in WIC and talk of more cuts to come. And you look at the school lunch program and school breakfast program, too. That's grown by leaps and bounds as families that normally didn't qualify, middle-income families who are now unemployed, and now their kids qualify. Fortunately, that program is still being funded, but it's you're absolutely correct. I mean, these investments in early childhood are just essential to get kids a fair shake, to get them a good start, to get them off and running so they can develop in a healthy way.
And there's more behind this than just the numbers, so give me what's behind this. When you look at the figures of the number of students in MPS schools in the city who are on free lunch, it's really high. It's like 80%, 85% in many of the schools. When you look at a lot of suburban schools, the figure is much, much lower, although that has increased some as the hard times have hit a lot of families. What's going on there? What's behind those numbers?
Well, I think really it's just that more kids are qualifying for these programs because we've had this unemployment debacle that's affected a lot of people, and I think it's it's just more eligible kids. And there's an interesting article in the New York Times a couple of days ago about this growth in the school lunch and breakfast programs, and parents that are accessing it for the first time for their kids are a lot of them are embarrassed and they want it to be kept secret that their kid is getting a subsidized or a free lunch because it's embarrassing to them. But I think at this point, and that's traditionally in this country been a factor that's prevented eligible people from accessing supports and programs that they're eligible to. They feel embarrassed to do it. But I think that this has been so severe for so many families, and you have so many people in long-term unemployment who have exhausted pretty much everything that they're accessing these programs now.
Thanks, Diane, for the call. Frank in Madison. Hi, Frank.
Hello, Kathleen.
Hi, Frank.
Truly a fine guest in a very important topic. I would like to point out, or perhaps your guest is aware of this, that in Canada, in the Trudeau era, Pierre Trudeau and Marc Lalonde instituted in a social experiment in an isolated community in Saskatchewan, a negative income tax. And there was a great deal. It was entirely voluntary, but the community as a whole engaged it, and there was a great deal of sociology done. And what they found was that all the negative indicators of distress went down. Truancy in the schools went down. Appearance at emergency rooms went down. Appearances in the courts of law went down. And so that approach where low incomes, and as an approach to poverty, are brought up above a threshold level uniformly and in a non-discriminatory fashion, it's not welfare, was proved to be valuable. The conclusion was that the money spent was less than the costs that occurred in the society in the absence of that type of income supplement. And of course, this was a social experiment in an era when positive government was still in good odor. And, of course, it was reversed in the 80s, almost universally in the advanced world. So perhaps your guest would like to comment.
Thank you, Frank.
Well, I think that's a super good point. And I think it's really true. And I think that often when we look at these budget cuts and look at when politicians say we're going to cut this and save this amount for Medicaid, they're looking at they don't look at the net effects of what that cut is going to do. So sure, you can cut Medicaid, for instance, and get some immediate savings by restricting certain services that people are entitled to, and so on. But if you, and restricting eligibility, which they've been prohibited recently by the federal government from restricting, states have, from restricting eligibility, but that might open up again. And but you look at the consequences. What it means often is that people without Medicaid go to the emergency room, because the law says they've got to be accepted in emergency rooms. They don't receive much more expensive care, are not able to access preventive care and regular trips to the doctor to prevent them from going to that emergency room. So if you really look at the net savings, sometimes there's no net savings. Sometimes there's a net cost to cutting a program, these essential safety net programs like Medicaid. So I think Frank's point was very, it makes a lot of sense that if you net out the effects, these programs doing something like a negative income tax will more than pay for itself with things like, as the caller mentioned, perhaps lowering crime rates, allowing workers to be more productive in their jobs. There are all kinds of different forms. So I think that point is very well taken.
Thank you, Frank, for your call, as always. Kenneth in Janesville. Hi.
Hello. Kathleen, you keep asking what's happened. I myself am a Vietnam veteran, and I went after the war. I came back and as a disabled veteran, went to school and got a degree in social work. And interestingly, you know, it wasn't President Nixon, and then we had Carter, and but I think ever since Reagan, my income was going down, and the programs were being cut, and even President Clinton is part of that story too. But the people in China have been coming out of poverty. And the real problem is that we should be doing what they're doing in Michigan, because it's employment. Wisconsin's minimum wage is the lowest in the area. It should be double of what it is. And most of the people that are poor are working. What Michigan is doing is paying tuition for people to train in jobs that are looking for people, and they're paying $5,000-$10,000 a year for people to train in the needed employment.
Professor Skinner.
Right. Well, that can be a very important thing to do. It's there's been some effort here in New York to do that as well. We've got a system of, they call them Workforce One centers, and they keep, and part of the deal is to try to analyze what are the growth occupations here in the city and the labor market, and which ones provide the living wage, and what the training needs might be. It's a little tricky to do, to try to make those calls, because sometimes they're judgment calls and you don't have the data, and you can end up training people for jobs that just aren't out there. And too many people can jump on a bandwagon to train for a particular occupation. But it's certainly a very important thing to do. And I think we need more of it.
And when you look, and I know that you've given us these figures at the number of poor families that have at least one parent who is employed full-time year-round, it just isn't enough. What's behind those figures? What kinds of jobs are those?
Well, I think a lot of them are jobs, they're surface-level jobs, that pay $10 or $11 an hour, and they simply don't put a family. If you've got one parent working full-time at a job like this, working hard, it's still not enough to pull the family above the poverty line. So we are just seeing all across the country an increasing number of these very low-paid jobs, and sometimes they don't even come with much in the way of benefits. Like you look at a Walmart's doing a little better, but But in the past, they often gave people very, very marginal benefits, if any. So that's part of the structure of the job market, and it's something what the just going back to one of the previous callers said, it is something that will have to be addressed, I think, on a poverty on a policy level, both federally and locally. And I think it's interesting that a number of localities are passing what they call living wage laws, and there's a movement here in New York to get one passed here. And it means, as you probably know, it means that that any business that contracts with the city to provide a service or a good or has to pay its workers a living wage, a wage that's enough to keep them above the poverty line. And there's increasingly a number of these initiatives, and there's been lots of concern about, well, this will make our city less competitive than other cities. But the research has shown that there seems to be very little, if any, effect, that often employers are drawn to a locality not because it pays rock-bottom wages, but because it pays their other important things for them, a good, reliable workforce, good markets for their product, and so on. So I think that's that can be part of the solution.
We're talking about the poor in America this hour of the show, and welcoming your phone calls. Our number is 800-486-8655. Professor Curtis Skinner, director of the Family Economic Security Team at the National Center for Children in Poverty, is our guest. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our next caller is Glenn in Manitowoc. Hi, Glenn.
Well, hello. I've been listening to the show for quite some time. And good morning.
Good morning.
I've been listening. I've been listening, and I have to agree in large part with our veteran that called in his observation of this. Pretty much started with Reagan, and taken in a little bit further the so-called free trade movement, and all the help the job creators get with tax breaks. I've been watching and made the same observation as he did. It's been going pretty much down the tubes for the last 30 years. This problem with poverty is only going to grow, despite strong efforts made by your guests and others, only because the producing jobs in this country are gone. And pretty much you can link that to virtually every problem we have, including our huge deficits. That if a nation is not a producing nation, as we were during the time of World War II, we won't be able to do anything about the larger problems on the horizon. We need to bring the producing jobs back. Everybody got an education, and, well, what has that got in our nation? They're still out of work. And now you've had guests call in with a considerable amount of education, making $11 an hour, et cetera. I'm one of the lucky few that have a producing job, and I'm making considerably more than that, but I know I'm a rarity.
Professor Skinner.
Well, it's true that we had these very well-paying producing jobs in this economy right up until the big hemorrhaging in the mid-70s, which has continued. And you can think of it as, you know, I think partly, as the caller says, more competition from abroad, but also the way some of these companies have structured their operations here, because they increasingly use much fewer workers to produce the same amount of output in a lot of producing industries. So that's, they've been automating, and they continue to do that. And again, probably some of that is the trade pressure. But if you look at, you know, the output from the manufacturing sector, it's declined a lot less than employment in the sector has declined over the past couple of decades. So part of the story is the automation. And I think the caller's got a good point, but I think it's going to be very difficult to make the producing industries a major employer again in this country. I don't know if they can be brought back, and I think that we need to work on improving the wages and improving worker organization in some of the industries that are growing. A lot of these are in education and health and things like business services. Education and health are a couple of the big ones, and they're facing a lot of problems with some of these attacks on union representation in the public health sectors and the public education sectors. But I think that's going to be a big part of the picture, because I think in terms of employment, it seems that, again, you can try to give incentives to business to hire more workers in these production industries. But I think it may be an uphill battle, and I think we kind of need to look at improving conditions in some of the growth industries.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Glenn. It just makes sense, doesn't it, that if no matter what kind of job you're doing, if you're out in the labor force and you're working 40 hours a week, that you ought to be able to not be in poverty.
Well, we absolutely think so. I mean, we think, you know, the person's doing what the person's supposed to do, is being responsible.
Right.
And society, it's a two-way street. And the individual contributes, and society's got to make sure that someone who's contributing is able to support his or her family at a decent standard. So I think it's something that needs to, and again, it's partly a political issue. We need to, as you mentioned before, we need to bring poverty back into the national discourse and get these numbers, make sure people know about what's happening here, these embarrassing numbers, and that there are solutions, and, you know, that it's not something, it's not a battle that cannot be won. It's there are solutions to this on a policy level. One very interesting, one actual good thing that's happened, I think, in fighting poverty over the last few decades has been the earned income tax credit.
Mm-hmm.
And that was originated back in the 70s, but it was really expanded quite a bit in the 80s and 90s, and to become more generous and to make more families eligible. And that probably is the single, has been the single most effective policy in fighting poverty in this country in recent years. So it's an example of something that works, and it gives an incentive for people to continue to work and to earn more, and it's been a success. And we need to make sure, again, there's some moves afoot to cut back the earned income tax credit on the federal level. Some states have programs too, and I think it's very important that we don't do that.
Mm-hmm. Brad, hi.
Hi there. The media has been paying attention solely to Scott Walker's attempt to make Wisconsin a right-to-work state and then collective bargaining. But what hasn't been discussed has been his attack on the poor and the disabled in this state with his budget and his other laws that he's passing. 69,000 people are going to be kicked off Badger Care very soon. 29,000 of them are children. And the Health Care Affordability Act doesn't kick in for a little while, I don't believe, and that will be high deductible insurance plans. Just because you have insurance doesn't mean it's good insurance. And the reason why the media and politicians don't pay attention to the poor is because they lack power, money, and they don't vote because they're apathetic. They don't think it makes any difference who gets elected. And the politicians, they live in a bubble. All they associate with is people that aren't poor and rich. That's my comments.
I think every point is right on the money, and I think it's true. I mean, the poor are taken for granted because they're not a political constituency, and they haven't been made so by those who can help organize them. So I think it is, you know, it's a big part of the picture. And I think as well, yes, it's really one great thing about Wisconsin. In fact, Wisconsin's got a somewhat lower poverty rate than most states, and Wisconsin has traditionally, I think, had a pretty strong social safety net, and one of its best programs is Badger Care. It's a generous and good program, and I think it's very much a shame that this program is being targeted for being cut. And I really think it becomes, ultimately, politicians have to be pressed by people who think otherwise. And the folks who think this is unfair and this is not the right way to go and there are other ways to balance a budget that are much less harmful and destructive have got to make that clear to their elected representatives and put some pressure on them.
Thanks, Brad. We go to Scott in Green Bay. We have about a minute left, less than that. Hi, Scott.
Hi. I think this is an extremely important issue. I read a book called Kingdom Ethics by Glenn Stassen. And he said that one of the points he made is both sides have a monolithic approach to it, where the left seems to think government can cure all the problems, and the right thinks that it's all social behavior, and we need to have a two-pronged approach to it. The one comment I want to make on a living wage is, and I do like the concept of it, but the problem is, here's the deal. I want to live in Palm Springs and work at McDonald's and get paid a living wage. And that's the crux of the problem. I don't think you can have that.
Mm-hmm. 10 seconds, Professor.
Well,
sorry.
Well, right. That really wouldn't apply to living wage unless McDonald's is, you know, has got a contract with the local government, and you know, and its workers would fall under living wage provision. But I think, in my opinion, no particular industry that is contracting with the local government would be exempted, including McDonald's.
Professor Skinner, thank you very much for your
time
and your work. Thank you. Our guest, Professor Curtis Skinner, Director of the Family Economic Security Team at the National Center for Children in Poverty. And we thank Octavia Brown, Head Start parent, member of the Parent Council's Executive Committee at Social Development Commission here in Milwaukee. Thanks to Chrissy Pease for producing the hour, and to Chrissy as well for on-air production. We'll be with you tomorrow at this time, something entirely different. Judy Garland. A gentleman who's from Milwaukee who's written the ultimate book about her. Please join us.